You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hello, New York. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate today. While having a dinner conversation with someone who passionately disagrees with you about politics can be a challenge for many of us, but for Democratic strategist James Carville and Republican strategist Mary Madeline, it's daily life, and they've been making it work for the last 20 years. Wow. Chronicled the ups and downs of their marriage in the new book, Love and War, 20 Years, Three Presidents, Two Daughters, and One Louisiana Home. It's published by Blue Rider Press, and I'm pleased to welcome James Carville to the show today. Hello, James.
How are you doing, Andy? I'm great. Doing good.
I'm sorry that Mary couldn't be with us today. Is she a little under the weather today?
She is. She's a kind of a recovering from a little surgery, but she's fine.
Oh, good. Fine. Good. Good to hear that. Well, now, we want to talk about the book, of course. We want to talk about your marriage, of course. Mm-hmm. But right now, I want to talk about this traffic jam Fort Lee situation, because I didn't even know about this. What to your knowledge is going on with Chris Christie?
Before I came here, I just clicked on a story, and then I called a friend of mine, and apparently the Times just posted a story that, you know, they shut this the mayor of Fort Lee endorsed Christie's opponent.
Right.
And I don't have this exact, but they have like four lanes off the GW Bridge to go to Fort Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they closed three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, well, no, it was just for a traffic study. And they said, no such thing. And now they have the emails, and they said, it's time for the emails leave no room for interpretation.
Time for a
traffic jam. And then there's one about the kids are having a hard time getting off, but their parents probably voted Democratic anyway. I mean, this is an old-fashioned rock 'em, sock 'em, political payback, urban politics, 1920-something throwback kind of scandal, and it's going to be a lot of fun watching it unfold here.
You seem to be just vibrating with excitement. This is an amazing day for you.
Well, it's not the kind of thing
that
it's not the kind of thing you expect in modern American politics.
Right.
It's usually like
it's old school.
Yeah, it's LIBOR, fooling with the LIBOR rate, you know, something boring like that, or contract influence this is like old school stuff that they used to be. Like, this is payback, you
right.
know?
Well, okay, you're a political consultant. You've had to handle some scandals in the past.
Right.
You've had politicians, I won't name names, but I think you've been involved with some
right.
politicians who've had scandals. So let's put yourself in these shoes. Like, you're suddenly Chris Christie's right-hand man,
right.
and you say there are these emails out there seeming to suggest.
No, they're pretty clear. I want to be clear with these emails that don't have a lot of room for interpretation, but I'm not a jury, so let's just say.
Right, so let's just say.
Damaging-looking emails.
But suddenly you're a Republican consultant.
Right.
I know that's a leap, but you are, and you're working for Chris Christie. What would you say? How would you tell him to deal with this?
Well, the first thing they did, they canceled his public schedule this afternoon. That
so
was
they're
not
already,
rocking.
They've already,
already
taken the first step.
That.
Okay.
Say, look, first and foremost, protect the governor. He didn't know anything about this.
Right.
And I was misled, and these following people have resigned, and we're going to cooperate because there's no way that we can take the most heavily trafficked bridge in the United States.
Right.
And turn it into some kind of a political thing. But I don't know how much he knew or who knows what or anything, but I don't know if this is criminal. But it's just kind of funny and interesting. It's a great story, and it's simple, and everybody can understand it.
I know. So shutting down a bridge.
Right.
Well,
right.
we'll see if it plays out. Well, right. He's already yeah. taken your first piece of advice, which right. is canceling his schedule.
That would
entirely.
Be a good idea right now.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, WNYC and WNYC.org. And I am talking to James Carville, who's got a great new book out with his wife, Mary Madeline, called Love and War, 20 Years, Three Presidents, Two Daughters, and One Louisiana Home. Okay, now, there is an assumption, which I think you probably haven't really persuaded people to not believe, which is that you and your wife are at loggerheads quite a bit about politics. But how much of this really does seep over to your private life? When you're on TV together, of course, it's good theater and
you know,
it's a vaudeville.
We talked about it in the book, and the thing that she said, and it's true, the two things that caused the greatest kind of tension in our marriage were the 2000 recount and the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those have something in common. They were relatively long ago, in 2003. You know, if you're going to have a big brouhaha in your marriage, a war is something worth having one over.
Right.
You know? And well, I think we both come to the conclusion that we're not going to change each other's minds, and there's a lot of other things to do in a marriage, and, you know, children, and a lot of other things that we agree on and we can do without arguing about politics. But and I think there are plenty of marriages, what people tend to forget, there are plenty of marriages out there that have real seated fundamental religious differences, ethnic, cultural differences. People hate each other's kids from previous marriages and they hate each other's in-laws. And so that political differences are not, I don't think, necessarily fatal to a marriage at all.
Do you rank them as less damaging than those other conflicts? I mean, it seems like if you hate each other's relatives, that might be more
easier to be. You know, a lot of people hate their in-laws. It's easier to be married to someone who hates my politics and hates my mother. You know, a lot of people are married to people who hate their mother, you know.
But, that's right. Well, yeah. Now, do you, when you have a big conflict, say about the recount or the Iraq war, do you eventually put that in a box and put it away?
Yeah, go silent. I'm a big believer in kicking the can down the road and not sort of confronting things, because if you confront them and you're in a certain mood, you're just going to say stuff that you're probably going to get thrown back in your face. And my wife points out we both, you know, debate a lot, and it'd be a lot of body slamming going on. So what we generally do when we have a big issue that we is we tend to just not talk for a while.
And just let it
slide.
But when one of these things comes up again, like, for example, we've been hearing in recent days about the problems with Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-based groups in Iraq, and, you know, Democrats and Republicans easily adopt sort of reflexive attitudes about that. They'll say, well, you know, Al-Qaeda wouldn't be in Iraq if we hadn't gone there or whatever.
Well, yeah,
do you guys tend to leave that behind, or...?
But my answer is, if you want to get them out, you send the American soldiers there to get them out, because I'm not.
Right. Right.
Yeah. They're there, and, you know, they were there before, and we deal with it. But
right.
we're not sending, at least in my view. And she probably is a little more jingoistic, a little more. But, you know, I think the experience of the last two wars in the Middle East have sort of cooled everybody's jets on sending kids over there.
We've had enough war for the time being. Okay, so you wrote this book in an interesting way. You have shifting perspectives between the two of you. She'll write a passage, you'll write a passage. Ultimately, would you try to edit each other? Would you give it? It was just completely unfiltered.
Completely, and it didn't. You know, we were sort of ringside or in the ring or somewhere in some pretty big events. The Clinton things in the late 90s, the recount, the 9/11, the Iraq war, lead up to the Iraq war, the Katrina recovery. And so we had seen a lot of things and been involved in a lot of things, and we'd been married for 20 years, so it seemed like a good time to sort of put some of this stuff down and talk about it. I'm glad we did. I'm very pleased with the way the book came out.
Well, now, it opens with your move to New Orleans, and I'm curious to know why you decided to move there. You had been the epicenter of Washington, D.C. for so long.
You know, the best, when I did, and somebody called me and I said, you know, I'm just like an old Jew. I'm going back to Jerusalem. I've been in Williamsburg for too long and just going home. You know, I've always been, I'm Louisiana through and through. The point in the book is, you know, just I'm sure that my veins are muddy brown water of the Mississippi River. But after the events of 2005, what I call engineering failure, what most people call Katrina, I realized that the fragility, that New Orleans couldn't be taken for granted, that it was a place that might not make it. And it weighed on me and weighed on me. And I'd been in Washington for a long time. I didn't hate Washington. I clawed, fought, schemed, plotted to get there. So it wasn't like not a Washington hater. But my wife liked it when we got married in New Orleans. She loved the place. And we just talked about it. It just seemed very kind of natural thing to do. And it was just from the day that we moved, it was very, very natural and very much the right thing to do. It felt good from day one.
Now, did she have any connection to the city as well?
She just loved it. Mm-hmm. When we got married, she was the one who insisted that we get married in New Orleans. That was her whole idea. And she's very person that's very, like, she likes smells and she likes lushness and verdant things. And there's a lot of that in New Orleans, that, you know, noises, rumbling streetcars, church bells. It has its own kind of sounds of a very unique kind of different place to live. And she was very supportive and very enthusiastic about the move and has remained so the whole time.
Well, you mentioned in the book that your entire family was very close to Tim Russert, the host of Meet the Press. And was his death was that in any way an impetus for your?
Well, no. What happened was is we had decided to move in 07, latter part 07. The first day that I'm in New Orleans, we flew down and I'm in my car, and I'll recount it in the book, and I'm driving down Arabella Street to a place called Langenstein's, which is a kind of famous old line grocery store in uptown New Orleans. And Al Hunt called and said, I got the worst news you can imagine. I think Tim just died. Mm. And then Barbara Fant called me, and I put that in the book. And it was our first day in New Orleans, the day that Tim died. And it was almost like Providence saying, well, you want to get all, you know, you want to move, you'll move. And, I mean, he was like, I dedicated the book to him. It was very close. We talked on the phone every day. And it was a blow. It was an unbelievable severance, from Washington.
Yeah, and he was a really galvanizing figure in the city, wasn't he? He was somebody that everybody seemed to. He was sometimes considered the mayor of the city.
Mark Leibovich in his book talks about Tim's funeral. But I mean, to a lot of people, he was a really powerful guy. Meet the Press had a cachet back then. It was it was like the he ran the NBC News Bureau. He was this and that. We had our tickets together. His son and I did a radio show together. And even in Washington, among sort of people forge relationships. It's just like I'm sure that people in New York and high powered people here forge relationships. We had a real, almost like family relationship, he was a real kind of one. One of my real things in Washington. He was really close and talked a lot and really connected to him.
I'm speaking with James Carville about his latest book, which he's co-written with his wife, Mary Madeline, Love and War, 20 Years, 3 Presidents, 2 Daughters, and 1 Louisiana Home, is published by Blue Rider Press, and we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, WNYC and WNYC.org, and I'm back with James Carville to talk about his bizarre bipartisan marriage. He's got a new book out with his wife, Mary Madeline, called Love and War, 20 Years, 3 Presidents, 2 Daughters, and 1 Louisiana Home. Now, your publisher very helpfully provides me with some FAQs that people always ask you about your marriage, you and Mary. And some of them, I must say, are very rude, I think.
Well, publishers do anything to sell a book. They
exactly.
Don't care,
And look what we're doing right here.
Right.
They say the one thing you're often asked is your marriage a sham? That strikes me as not a polite question to ask anybody.
Is it
a sham?
Well, that's a 20-year sham if it is one. So it's the longest-running sham. I think that was one of the things that was when we got married. There was considerable amount of commentary to that effect. It was a stunt. It was a... then it can't blame people for thinking that. But I guess after 20 years, you've got a lot of history behind you.
Right. And if it was all a stunt to get on cable news, not enough people watch cable news to really make it worthwhile.
Yeah, that would be a hell of a price to pay to be on cable news, to be married to someone you didn't want to be married to. Huh?
Now, while we're on this topic of cable news, it's in a very debased state from where it was when you were doing Crossfire so long ago. It's now the audiences have really dwindled, and now I see that CNN has brought Crossfire back,
right,
with Newt Gingrich.
And I think I'm trying to do it. look, if you look at the whole thing, it's elections and big events help them. But, everything goes through gets reinvented, and probably what's going on in cable news right now. And I think that the news, I was reading that the new guy in charge of cable news said that it would go more toward entertainment shows and things like that. So who knows? I'm not a media. I don't understand the media. I don't understand what makes it go or not go. It always surprises me, and it's good. But I love my time at CNN. I got to be part of, I think, three different election nights, which is sort of mega events. And they wanted their contributors to be either in Washington or New York to be on set. And I can understand that. And mm-hmm. I'd move to something else. And, you know, we were talking earlier before this, to everything there's a season.
That's right.
You know, and don't try to extend your season.
Have you seen the new version with Newt Gingrich?
I did, yeah.
What do you think? How do you think Newt is doing?
If you have if he wasn't doing well, I wouldn't say so. But I think they do. I think it's fine. It just takes a while. Look, when we were doing it at the end, honestly, the show wasn't that good. Mm-hmm. Right? It was any show is about to, in its last throws. The network didn't put a lot into it. We'd probably gotten a little sloppy and understood the decision to yank the show when they did. And bringing it back is. Take some time, but I've watched it any number of times. Like I said, I'm hoping to get on there tomorrow if I can get back down to Washington. I want to do the show, and I had fun doing it, and it can be a lot of fun.
Now, you don't talk a lot about your years in the Clinton administration in this book, but after you left the White House...
I never actually worked in the White House.
Will you clarify the difference for me? Because you were very associated with Bill Clinton.
Right, I was, and I was very much of associated with him. I was campaign manager in 1992.
Right,
I was probably his chief defender during the Lewinsky.
Right, which created the impression that you might have worked in the White House.
Right,
but you weren't.
Right, I wasn't paid by the government. I often said I wouldn't live in a country whose government would hire me.
Well, that's an interesting. Point to make, because actually you have been hired by a lot of foreign governments to do foreign campaigns. I keep on giving you official status campaign.
All of my life I've tried to get away from official. I haven't done any domestic political consulting since President Clinton was elected.
Well, now that's interesting to me. Why, you had this tremendous rocket of success in the early 90s.
Because
why didn't you just, like so many people in Washington, just play that out and sign up for another one?
Somebody said something that I think is true and I've lived by it. It says, in the United States, when you become famous, the only way you can earn a living is by being famous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, if I started to, there was a time I did campaigns all the time. First of all, like anything else, one of the great tragedies of this economy is people, when they don't do a job for a while, they lose their skills.
Mm-hmm.
Plumber, if you're out of work for a long time, you're not as good a plumber as you were before. It doesn't matter what it is. That's particularly true of political consultants. And people always ask me, and I would be horrible getting back into the game now. The technology, everything has sort of changed. So I didn't do it. And then you become a distraction. And, do you work in a campaign or do you go give a corporate speech for a lot more money? And I said, I'm going to go give the corporate speech.
Right.
I did do any number of foreign. I think I've worked in 22 different foreign countries.
What were some of those countries? And I want to clarify, you did not work for the government.
I did.
You worked for individuals.
Afghanistan.
Really?
Yeah. The Seychelles.
Mm-hmm.
Israel. Argentina.
Mm-hmm. Whose campaign did you work for in Afghanistan, just out of curiosity?
I worked for a man named Ashraf Ghani, mm-hmm. who is literally... He's close to like a saint. He got 1% of the vote.
So that's not on your LinkedIn profile, maybe not.
I asked when Richard Holbrook was at the State Department, and I said, before I go to work for somebody there, I called and I said, what do you know about this guy, Ashraf Ghani? He says, he's the most decent, best man I've ever known in my life. And I said, I don't think this guy, I know he can't pay me. I said, Richard, I don't think he can pay my airfare. if I'm going to get, and he said, James, you have to go. You're a member of the Kennedy generation. So I'm like, geez, they're throwing John Kennedy. So I went, and I stayed at his house for a couple of days and, wrote a campaign plan for him. And I'm happy to say I did get reimbursed for my plane fare. With a happy ending in that. And he gave me a rug, which I still have.
But now, that's fantastic. Now, but when you go to a country like the Seychelles or Afghanistan, How does your skill set apply to such different cultures? How do you make the translation?
What I do is communications. Mm-hmm. And you would be – people receive communications in much the kind of same ways. It would be a different system. Some, you know, parliamentary democracy works a lot different than ours, different kind of traditions. But the ability to communicate simply mm-hmm. and repeatedly – is something that it sounds so simple, but it's so difficult to execute. And that's basically what you try to stress to people, and you give them ways to do that. You know, it's the old line I'm trying to use is that when you build a bridge, you know, you should never talk about the bridge. You should talk about the people who live on either side of the stream and what it means, and give mm-hmm. people sort of a human connection. And I think that people take your advice, which is rare, can be helpful to some people.
You're talking about bridges again, which is a sore subject in New Jersey. So,
oh my God,
be,
yes!
Did I say the B word? You said the B word.
Yeah, we saw you slip that in. Right
now, so when you were, let's talk about the change in sort of the partisan landscape, because you and Mary, of course, are seen as this kind of, you know, you have this for lack of a better word, it is sort of a vaudeville act. You guys get up and you entertain people with your different opinions. I'm not saying it's a sham, and I'm not saying it's a put on. I'm just saying that's the gist of what you do. And yet what you do seems so much more restrained and quaint than a lot of the rancorous debate that we're now treated to in Washington and on debating shows on, you know, MSNBC and Fox, where they're bringing in sort of a straw man and they have someone else tearing them down. Do you feel that, you know, since you clawed your way to Washington in the early 90s, do you feel that the atmosphere has grown ridiculously toxic, or is it just are we in the media sort of exaggerating that?
Well, first of all, it is, and I think that it's to some extent it's caused. I teach at Tulane. I talk about this a lot. Is, you know, when I went to LSU in the early 60s, you got the Baton Rouge paper. And that was it. If you wanted to read the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you had to go to, like, the library, and you got mm-hmm. it 4 days late on a long stick.
Right.
And that was it. Now
the wood stick.
Yeah, the wood stick. Now these kids, they give away the newspapers. They go to any website. And the truth of the matter is, if you're a liberal, you never have to listen to another conservative thing for the rest of your life.
Right.
And the same thing if you're a conservative. So I think, actually, the proliferation and segmentation of information has not been the best thing for us. I don't know what the solution to it is, but I think it's allowed everybody to segment. And people, as I say, use the news the way that a drunk uses a lamppost for support, not
right.
illumination. They
right.
want to know. They want to, when people listen, no one listens to Rush Limbaugh to find out what happened. They listen to Rush Limbaugh to find out. I tell you, I was right the whole time.
Right. I, you know, it's funny. In New York, you don't run into too many people who watch Fox News. But when I do, I'm interested in what they like. And I ran into a woman recently who said she was a Fox News viewer. And I said, what do you like about it? And she said, they agree with everything I think. And so she's reassured. And I'm not actually calling out Fox News viewers, because I think MSNBC is Fox for vegans. I think it's the same thing. It's just on the other side.
Yeah, they do. And some of the stuff, I mean, it's, you know, I like to listen. I'll go on there. I'll argue with anybody, you know. But it's also interesting because you get a sort of insight as to what their argument is, or
right.
what their sort of complaint is.
Right. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org, and I am talking to James Carville, who has written a new book with his wife, Mary Madeline. It's called Love and War, 20 Years, Three Presidents, Two Daughters, and One Louisiana Home. So what is it like raising daughters? You have two daughters, right?
I do. One is a freshman in college and one is sophomore in high school.
And you know, they grew up in this atmosphere where the two of you were having all of these debates. What are their politics like?
You know, it hadn't had much to do. My oldest daughter very much likes the right. I would describe her politics as sort of modern feminism.
Mm-hmm.
My youngest daughter's in the 10th grade, and she's probably, you know, her. If I had to guess, if you asked, you know, how does a 10th grader know what they want to do and why even. You know, let them be young, and I don't think that they look to me for guidance. And I wouldn't want kids like that. That, you know, they do well, they work hard. They do well in school, and that really, if they, as long as they're happy, I really don't give a damn about their politics. I really don't.
So now you have not been involved, to my knowledge. You probably do a lot of things that I'm not aware of, but you haven't been sort of in the Obama camp.
No.
You've been sort of an outsider,
right.
As happens in these, as you say, everything has its season. What's your assessment of his presidency, both in terms of his policy and in terms of his political achievements?
Let me start. He's amazing because he is a man who has gone very far in politics that really doesn't like politics, which is kind of an achievement. It would be, you know.
What makes you say he doesn't like politics?
He doesn't like people that much. He would much rather do homework with his daughters than, you know, sit around and schmuck around with a bunch of politicians. And a lot of people like that. It's just interesting that he's in politics.
Right. His daughters are people, by the way. They're the people he likes.
Yes, in his family. And he's not a...
I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah. But...
He doesn't like Hank. He's not like a people person. Like Bill Clinton is a people person.
Exactly.
Maybe too much of one at times. Yeah.
But look... His administration has been, you know, damn consequential.
Right.
I mean, and if you look at the biggest story going on right now, bar none, is the flattening of these health care costs, which basically I thought that we were going to owe that, and so did a lot of other people, by the way, that you know, health care costs were going to doom us as a country if we didn't do something. And the last 4 years have been really, really encouraging. It's a huge story.
Mm-hmm. But... It's a huge story we're not really hearing well. I mean, it's interesting. You talk about his administration being consequential. It seems to me sometimes the most consequential things he does, he has a very hard time communicating, or he doesn't speak with the same kind of precision that he had as a candidate. Now, as a candidate, it's easier to say, you know, say inspiring things.
I think he says, I have made. It, by and large, a lot of right choices in this country. I saved the auto industry, propped up the banks. That's I'm only the first president to change health care. And if you can't appreciate that, then too bad for you. I think it's a little bit like, I'm a smart guy. I have smart people around me. I make, and, you know, you have people, and I think a little bit of that is the way that he feels. And he probably has some people have been around him for too long that probably reinforce that. But having said that, I would be the first to acknowledge that if he's made 10 major decisions, 8.5 of them have been pretty doggone good, which is a pretty good rate.
Now, what do you think of we had this decision yesterday coming out of the Senate that they're at least going to advance the whole notion of extending unemployment benefits, and there was some like a tiny hint of cooperation across the aisle. A few Republicans cooperated. Is this being overstated as a big development, or are some people in Washington sort of getting fatigued with the Tea Party divisiveness and sort of the Ayn Rand approach?
Yeah, like most things, it's somewhat true. What the catalyst of this was the senator from Nevada, the Republican senator, Senator Heller. His state has 9.5% unemployment. And they know he knows people that are looking for jobs that just can't find them. So he's not buying into these people are just being propped up.
Right.
It's a real kind of human story here.
Right.
And so and what more and more economists are saying, this is not – there's always been this feeling that, hey, if they just got off their lazy butts and went out there and did something, and we just don't have that kind of demand in our economy right now. It's a real, real, real bad story. And so I think the reality is finally starting to seep into some people.
Right. But during the budget debate, John Boehner also expressed some impatience with – people who were opposing things, the people on the right and the Tea Party wing who were sort of opposing things before they even knew what they were about.
Right.
Do you think there's a sense among the Republicans that, hey, wait a minute, we really, you know, made a big goof this past fall when we shut down the government without knowing really why we were doing it? Is there backlash now?
The smartest thing said on this was by Mitch McConnell, actually, who said that the saying in Kentucky that the best education is the second kick of a mule.
That's a good line.
They shut the government down in 95, and then they shut it down now. They've been kicked by the mule twice, and they got the message.
Right.
It is a great line.
Well, we have to go back to the Clintons. I have to take one more visit to the Clintons before goodbye. But Hillary 2016, whatever is being said officially, and I guess very little is being said officially, it's obviously an eventuality that we're all going to have to deal with. We're all going to have to look at this candidacy. Have you been called in to discuss anything?
No, I'm
anything?
Not.
Are you too busy with the Seychelles?
I have a lot of friends that are, you know, obviously. I would say this, and I think this is a pretty common thought. I would not be surprised if she ran, but I wouldn't be shocked if she didn't run.
Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't she run?
You know, she's a very deliberate person.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to go through this, and she would have her own reasons. Could be any number of them. Maybe she doesn't want to go through it. I don't know. I would not be surprised if she ran. Would be shocked. I think my own instinct tells me it's more than likely than not that she runs. That's no based on no particular inside information. But it's not close to 100%
mm-hmm.
at all.
It may be closer to 100% now that she heard about this whole Chris Christie bridge thing. That may.
I think Jeb Bush is probably the guy that's the most excited about this, to tell you the truth. I think it kind of opens up that end of the party for him.
Of course. I've been speaking with James Carville about his latest book, which he's co-written with his wife, Mary Madeline. It's called Love and War, 20 Years, 3 Presidents, 2 Daughters, and 1 Louisiana Home, and it's published by Blue Rider Press. And he and Mary will be in conversation with Bud Mishkin tonight at 8 at the 92nd Street Y, and they'll be speaking tomorrow afternoon at 12:30 in the Celeste Bartos Forum at the main branch of the New York Public Library. For more information about both events, visit our show page. And Mr. Carville, it was such a delight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and thanks for crossing that bridge with me.